2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
The headline today was President Joe Biden's administration began their second annual Summit for Democracy, bringing together leaders from over 120 countries to engage in shared goals and also to provide and assert U.S. leadership for free governments around the world. But behind the photo ops and the handshakes, there are countless competing interests, a lot of divided voices. The question for me is the view from the summit a vision of freedom for the future? Or is the summit just one more uphill battle and an impossible dream? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day?
Think again.
We're really thrilled to have back on the program Ishan Tharoor, a great foreign affairs columnist and anchor of today's worldview at The Washington Post, and has an excellent piece today in The Washington Post on President Biden's Summit for Democracy, how it's a tough hill to climb, what it is, what it isn't, what it means. And Ishan, thanks so much for joining us on what I know is a very busy day for you in Washington, D.C., as always.
Great to be back with you, as always.
So as you look at this summit, this really has been something that the president has done really kind of in the name of we're going to reassert the United States as leader of the free worlds and as a stable, consistent friend out there. Tell us what has really happened at the summit in terms of what the president's kind of high level goal is versus some of the conversations underneath.
Well, the high-level goal is one that they've been pretty explicit about and consistent about since President Biden's campaign in 2020. He cast his leadership, he cast his, you know, the return of the Democratic administration to power as one that will restore, as you said, American leadership on the world stage to a certain extent. And a big part of that restoration is this reinvigoration of an idea of a liberal democratic project. I say liberal in more global terms.
Yeah.
They really believe that what the 4 years of the Trump presidency represented, as well as, of course, developments in various other parts of the world, both in democracies as well as the entrenching nature of autocracy in places like China and Russia and so forth, they feel like there is a kind of global battle of ideas, of politics happening, and that it's the U.S.'s responsibility to hold the line. In an ideological sense, forget about, you know, policies when it comes to hard geopolitics.
Yeah.
And this Summit of Democracy, which began in 2021, the first one was 2021, we're currently in the middle of the second one. And who knows if there'll ever be another one again. That's not exactly clear. It's about, you know, finding a kind of like-minded grouping of nations to really think hard about the challenges facing democracies everywhere.
Yeah, so important. And I thought it was interesting, and you noted this in your piece, that the State Department release, press release just before the event began, was that we really had to, democracies had to come together to rejuvenate and improve our open, rights-respecting societies from within to stand together in defending against threats from autocracies. And so give us some perspective in terms of how that part is playing out, particularly as it relates to places like Ukraine, where the president has really tried to cast thing as this fledgling democracy that is Ukraine against the tyranny of Russia.
Well, I mean, and this is where we get straight to the heart of the problem about this democracy, is that there's no even and consistent narrative around how this is playing out as far as an American roadmap or agenda is concerned. Obviously, the United States is heavily invested in the defense of Ukrainian sovereignty, its framing, its investment in that war, against the Russian invasion as one that is very much about bolstering a fledgling democracy in Europe. It's framed, the president went to Kiev and then the Polish capital, Warsaw, and spoke very bluntly and dramatically about how this is really the kind of fault line between democracy and autocracy, and that it's a political good to invest in the defense of democracy here. And I think you find that most of the U.S.'s European partners, all democracies elsewhere in the West, are really happy with the way the administration has rallied around Ukraine, coordinated the defense of Ukraine, really built a kind of Western consensus around that. But that, of course, is one issue, and there's so many other issues facing the world that are challenging our idea of a clear solidarity between democracies. You know, we're seeing just this week alone real friction between the United States and Israel, right. Which, of course, is always pats itself on the back as the Middle East sole genuine democracy. And there are many other examples of the tensions inherent in this project.
And so interesting. I'm glad you raised Israel, because I think that is one of those really interesting challenge points. You noted in your piece that Benjamin Netanyahu had already recorded a video message for the Democracy Summit and submitted it. Any other insight there in terms of what that is, what actually might get aired at the summit?
Yes, it was already aired this morning. And we've seen in the hours since, especially via the Israeli Prime Minister's social media, an articulation of real difference with the U.S. Of course, President Biden yesterday criticized Netanyahu's efforts to overhaul his country's judicial system, which critics say would make the judiciary in Israel much less independent. Netanyahu has since come back and said a number of things that have really pointed to a dramatic decline in deterioration in relations between the U.S. and Israel, or specifically between Netanyahu and the White House. And that is an issue that will not be resolved particularly easily. We're in a pretty sticky period right now for U.S.-Israeli relations. But when it comes to the Summit for Democracy, there are a whole host of questions that comes up when you think about the roster of speakers, who gets to be invited, who isn't invited. The U.S. did not invite, say, the Prime Minister of Hungary or the President of Turkey to speak, because the view in Washington about these countries is that they are led by illiberal, demagogic nationalist leaders who are undermining these democracies. And why would you want to give these kinds of leaders a platform? At the same time, they've given Netanyahu a platform. They've given Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi a platform. And even when Modi is widely seen by his critics as taking India's democracy in a particularly illiberal and dangerous direction. And so the question of what the themes here are is an important one. And I don't think there are single clear answers about that. People in the administration will come back to you and say that we're not pretending that this is a particularly easy project. We're approaching this with humility, but they still believe that it is important to have this kind of political space where both the leaderships of democracies, as well as the whole world of civil society leaders, are convening in these. Both these sessions are also in person, but there are also many hybrid sessions as well. And then there are critics who say that all of this is just a bit of a talk shop and nothing much more than that.
Yeah, and that's always the interesting thing of when do you lean into those conversations? And while there are vast disagreements on a whole host of issues, is some conversation better than no conversation? As you said, it's kind of that debate of, are we giving someone a platform that maybe is going more down the authoritarian route, or are we giving groups that may have a different kind of agenda some spotlight as well? I know there's a lot of people on the policy wonk side of things as well who have criticized it in terms of what it is and mostly what it isn't doing, particularly as it relates to things like climate and human rights and some of those things. So as you mentioned right at the beginning, I want to close out with this, and that is, what is the future of this? Is there really a future? Is this one that is just such a big hill to climb, as you titled it in your piece in the Post, or is this something that can get some legs and become part of an important conversation moving forward?
You would expect there to be another version of the summit if there's another Biden administration in the White House after 2024, or another Democratic leader. But that's certainly not clear. It's very, very clear that a return of, say, President Trump to the White House would lead this enterprise to go the way of the dodo bird. It hasn't, in and of itself, formed any significant part of American foreign policy or national security policy that subsequent administrations would feel particularly wedded or would feel obligated to continue this. As an exercise, this is a forum that has few mechanisms that enforce any kind of behaviors on the part of the country. It doesn't really implement anything particularly meaningful. You know, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars mobilized around initiatives discussed at this forum, which is a real drop in the bucket when you consider what the U.S. dishes out and all sorts of other projects and initiatives around the world. So I would not have particular confidence that this is a format that's going to necessarily stick for years to come.
Great insight. Great piece in The Washington Post. It's titled Biden Summit for Democracy is a Tough Hill to Climb. Great analysis, as always. Ishan Tharoor, I always appreciate your perspective.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's good to have Ishan on the program. And this is an interesting one. I do think, and I do commend the administration for attempting a summit for democracy. I think it's important to call for these kind of conversations, even though they're complicated. And all the players on the global stage, including the U.S., has areas where they're not doing so well on a freedom index or a democracy index. But we still need to convene it, and we still need to have it. And yes, we can get caught up in the headline of who was invited and who wasn't and who got to speak and who didn't. But I think we have to go beyond that. And so I think this is a starting point, but I think there's much more that we have to get to. And as Ishan pointed out, it is a difficult path. It is a tough road to hoe, and it is a very steep climb. But freedom is always worth the climb.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
We often talk about the Utah model in terms of solving problems, getting things done, making sure that government is actually doing things that are helpful to the citizens. Our next guest is a striking example of that and how one person at a local level can not just have an impact on the local community or the state or the nation, but the whole planet. Amelia Powers Gardner is the Utah County Commissioner and was actually featured in Jewish Insider talking about something she did a little while back. And Amelia, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Boyd.
Now, I only had one beef with the article in the Jewish Insider, and that was that they deemed you to be a bureaucrat. And you are not a bureaucrat. You are a problem solver. And so other than that, I think it was a pretty good piece. But the focus was the fact that some of the things that you did as an elected official really changed the process and some of the things that are happening in Israel relating to marriage. So give us the backstory.
Yeah, I too thought that was kind of entertaining. They called me a bureaucrat. I think I'm a bureaucrat's worst nightmare.
Yeah, exactly.
But so we didn't really set out to change the world, right? I joined government to try to make things easier for citizens, and I started right here in Utah County, saying, "Hey, if we can't fix it here, where else, you know, could fix it?" So, being the heart of innovation and the heart of Utah, I thought, let's make things easier. And one of the areas we targeted was marriage licenses. I was married 4 months before I took office, and my husband had to take a day off of work before our wedding. We, with three children in tow, went down to the marriage license offices and filled out pieces of paper on clipboards with pencils, and then handed those clipboards to employees of the county who got paid a full wage, benefits, and retirement to retype everything we had just written. And I just thought, you know, there's got to be a better way to do this. So we started by launching an online marriage license portal, letting people get a marriage license without ever having to come to a government office.
Yeah.
We launched that in January of 2020, pre-pandemic. And so that's really how this whole thing started was, hey, let's make the government easy to do business with.
Yeah. And so, of course, that was the start, and a January 2020 start to something online is always an interesting place to start. Of course, the pandemic hit, and suddenly you were getting requests from not just all over the country, but all over the world.
Right. And so then we start getting calls from, you know, Governor Cuomo's office in New York City, and we start getting calls from a couple, one in the UK and one in Texas, saying, hey, can we use your marriage licenses? And we said, well, you can only use those marriage licenses right here in Utah. But then it occurred to me, if I'm performing the marriage and I'm sitting in Utah, does that mean that this marriage is valid? And we looked into the legality of that. And we said, you know what? If judges are allowing people to appear in court via Zoom, then we should allow people to appear before us to get a get married via Zoom. So 2 months into 2 weeks to flatten the curve, I said, y'all, this is crazy. Why are we stopping families from forming? I believe the family is the base unit of society. And the fact that a government or governments all over the world were telling people they couldn't be married, I said, if a judge can make you appear before them via Zoom, I'm going to start performing weddings via Zoom.
Wow. And that and thus the ripples began again all around the world as you were able to do those again via Zoom during the pandemic. But ultimately, this ended up having an impact on Israeli law.
Yeah. So what happened is in Israel, marriage is controlled by the rabbinate, which is basically the religious authority. So in Israel, up until now, civil marriage has not been allowed. And that includes for people that maybe just aren't religious or people that are getting married cross-religious. So if we had a Jewish person who wanted to marry a Christian person or a Muslim person that wanted to marry a Jewish person, none of those marriages were allowed in the country of Israel. They would fly to Cyprus and get married and then come back to Israel, or they would take a boat out to international waters. But even that was shut down during the pandemic. So these couples, basically anyone that wasn't an Orthodox religious couple, came to us here and said, will you perform our marriages? So we started performing these marriages in Israel, and we had several people who turned these marriages in to qualify for civil marriage in Israel, and the Minister of the Interior denied the marriage. But the problem is that because they're part of the Geneva Convention, obviously the U.S. is too, these marriage certificates had what's called an apostille seal, meaning under the Geneva Convention, it's a government document that has to be accepted. Well, here we are 2 years later, almost 3 years later, and Israel's Supreme Court found unanimously that marriages performed by Utah County via Zoom are in fact valid in Israel.
And there you have it, folks. That's how things get done. And too often we sit back and we say, well, it can't be done, or we can't do this, or we can't do that. Or we look to Washington, D.C. to solve all the problems, and we wait for Congress to do some big, massive, 1,000-plus page bill and work that all the way through. We have to remember it's community and culture that lead, and Washington will follow. And this is just such a great example of that. And Amelia, as you've continued your journey, obviously you've gone on from being the Utah County Clerk to now being on the Utah County Commission. And as you look at that, what are some of the other things beyond marriage licenses that we ought to be looking at in terms of how can we just do this better? How do we better serve the people really using that Utah model?
I think the first thing we need to look at is remote services. Those became more popular during COVID, but in general, we shouldn't expect people to take a day off work to come into a government office to get a paper document. Anytime we can serve them remotely utilizing technology, I think we should look at doing that, making government more convenient for people. Instead of making people bend to our office hours, we should recognize that we serve those citizens and we should try to work within the convenience of their lives. And that's my goal right now. I'm starting with the health department. That's kind of my project for this year. See how many of these services can we let people sign up for remotely so that a single mom isn't taking time off work to get a a birth certificate to register her child for kindergarten, that sort of thing.
Great stuff. Amelia Powers Gardner, Utah County Commissioner, and an innovator, a problem solver, not a bureaucrat. And your ripples have gone all the way around the world. Amelia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Boyd. My pleasure.
All right. That's just good old-fashioned Utah model making something happen. And it just shows you, it shows you the power of being a problem solver. And the fact that as Utah County Clerk, Amelia had already been working on this before the pandemic even came. To say, look, how can we make this easier and better for our constituents? How can we make it so they don't have to take a full day off of work or a half day off of work just to get some paper filed or to fill out some form that then is going to be re-entered into a computer by somebody? And the fact that she did that then set off this amazing series of events. You'll have to check out the article. It was in the Jewish Insider, and just highlights how this all came about and how it impacted everything from New York to everywhere across the United States and ultimately around the world. Because we solved the problem. And then it happened to have real great application during the midst of a pandemic. But the problem is that far too often, we don't look to that local government, those local elected officials, to get things done. We expect some massive thing to come out of Washington, D.C. With pixie dust and fairy and all kinds of money to fix things. And that's just not how it works. So we can do better. We have to do better. And Amelia Powers Gardner is showing what it means not to be a bureaucrat, but to be a problem solver and an innovator, and to use the Utah model to literally impact the world. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. Much more coming up on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Stick around.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
House Republicans have introduced their number one priority for the 118th Congress. It is an energy package. And, of course, it is H.R. 1. That's the first bill. So the question today is, what's in the bill? And more important, what kind of energy policy debate should we be having while this bill is on the table? And to help us break all of that down and give us some behind the scenes there, one of our great inside sources, Phil Rossetti, senior fellow at the R Street Institute, where he focuses on energy, climate, and environmental policy. And Phil, welcome back to the show. And give us a sense, what is in H.R. 1?
Yeah, thanks for having me. So I'd break down H.R. 1 into kind of three broad categories. The first is it contains a major permitting reform, which would affect all energy across the board and really all infrastructure in the United States. And it's primarily aimed at addressing litigation risks. And there's been a big problem where a project gets approved and then it gets sued and then it has to get go through environmental reviews a second time around and so forth. So that's a big part of H.R. 1 is trying to improve that process. The second big provision is a lot of focus on domestic energy production. So a lot of things like allowing existing permits to be used more broadly and addressing like royalty rates for oil and gas and things that are aimed at trying to bolster U.S. production, especially on the oil and gas front. And then the last element is a lot of focus on trying to hold the administration accountable for not doing things that it's supposed to be doing, like holding leases and giving permits to drill and not providing much documentation or insight as to why things are not moving the way they should, especially on the permitting front. So that's kind of it in a nutshell, is those three broad points. And I just got to say, it's a little impressive that Republicans have focused so much on a pretty serious package for H.R. 1. It's more than just a messaging effort. It really is focused on the policy elements pretty significantly.
Yeah, and I think that's such an important message to be sending out there in an era of distraction and a lot of performative politics, this is a very serious bill. And I actually want to kind of go through each of those elements, starting with the permitting reform, because I think this is one of those areas where there is a little bit of wraparound bipartisan support as it relates to permitting. You talked about litigation and those environmental reviews, and often that becomes such a vicious cycle. And normally we think about that when it comes to an oil well or an energy production facility. But we're also seeing the same problems in terms of permitting and litigation and review as it comes to projects like wind and solar.
Yeah, actually, we're seeing permitting is a much bigger issue for renewables and clean energy than it is for oil and gas. And a lot of this is because the clean energy stuff doesn't always have existing processes for getting through environmental review the way that oil and gas does. So there are these things called categorical exclusions, and it's been interesting because a lot of the well-understood impacts of drilling for natural gas, that gets categorically excluded, and then some of the same technology is used for geothermal and doesn't. So it's, you know, this kind of weird process where it's like, hang on a second, this, you know, really shouldn't be this mismatch. You know, we should have a clear handle on it. And you're absolutely right that this is a bipartisan element. Senator Schumer, you know, he really was not happy about H.R. 1, and he released this whole statement thrashing it. And then practically the same breath, he says, but the bipartisanship that we can have on permitting is really good. And you know, maybe there's a conversation to be had here. And we're seeing this because pretty much nothing can get built without having to go through a process that is less about environmental outcomes and more about addressing litigation risks, where because a project might get sued, they have to think about what they could get sued on. And everything under the sun is just getting held up in courts. And everyone's kind of saying like, okay, we just got to have some clarity here and know what we've got to do.
Yeah, really hard for any kind of business or organization to invest in anything when they just have no certainty in terms of the process, that it might take them 10 years to get a permit, but then they might end up in court spending, you know, millions of dollars and a lot of time after that. And so just some certainty in that process. And so do you think there will be a good debate around that, at least that component to it on the permitting side?
Absolutely. And a lot of the permitting reform efforts that are in H.R. 1 are similar to things that Democrats have embraced in the past. Even last Congress, under Manchin, there was a pretty significant permitting reform that had a lot of overlap with the Republican effort. And a lot of it is just saying, like, okay, let's get the statute of limitations down from, you know, 6 years to 120 days or 150 days, depending on which bill it's been. Though H.R. 1 is 120 days, which is pretty much an industry standard. Usually it's actually even shorter than that, like 30 days, 90 days. Another thing is some of the big reforms that happened under Obama, which were only focused on major projects, the Republicans are trying to take those efforts and apply them more broadly. So things like if you're going to sue a project, you have to have submitted a comment during the public comment period and so that the agencies preparing the documents can actually address it ahead of time instead of, you know, coming out of left field. Because we've seen that for a lot of projects, they get approved and then they can have shovels in the ground already. And then someone sues it and the courts say, hold on, you got to stop because we got to vet this. And sometimes it ends up being serious and sometimes it doesn't. So there's just got to be more understanding of what agencies need to actually address in their reviews.
Yeah. Give us just a really quick snapshot, encapsulation of the domestic production portion of this, as well as kind of the holding the administration accountable on the what they're holding in terms of leases and so on.
Yeah. So this has been a kind of an ongoing issue under this administration where there are leases that they're supposed to sell. So they're required to hold lease sales every 4 or 5 years or so, and they just haven't been doing that. So there have been the Inflation Reduction Act actually required more lease sales. So hey, you got to hold these lease sales, and they haven't. So this is another thing for H.R. 1 saying, hey, we're going to take that approach and we're going to broaden it and say, you do need to hold these lease sales. You need to lift any moratoriums on lease sales. And also what they call a APD, application to permit to drill. So it's there are all these leases that people hold, and they want to drill for oil and gas on these lands, but they don't have the permit to do that because they need it from the federal government. So saying, hey, you've got to actually do this, because we've seen that there have not been nearly as many of these permits given under this administration. So the reason for that is, you know, I'll leave that to others to speculate about, but this is something that the Republicans have said, hey, you know, there seems to be some kind of hiccup in the works here, and we want to make sure that the administration knows that Congress is telling them they have to do this.
Yeah. Great insight, as always. Is there anything in the bill surprise you, or anything you got to be watching as we march it forward?
You know, I think the real thing to watch here is going to be, like you said, the permitting stuff, because it's going to go to the Senate, and the Senate Democrats are not going to be happy about probably 75% of it, but they know that they want to do a permitting effort, and they're going to say, hey, you know, maybe there are even more things that we should be talking about, because some people say the permitting reforms don't go far enough. So if the Democrats want to even try to take it to the next step, that would be interesting to see. But that's where I think the real debate is going to happen. And some of the other focus on, like, the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund and other elements that become more politicized, those I think are going to be less of a focus as it moves through the Senate.
Yeah, great insight as always. Philip Rossetti, senior fellow at the R Street Institute, focused on energy, climate, and environmental policy. Phil, thanks for joining us today. HR1 is on its way. It'll be fascinating to see how this all plays out in the weeks ahead. All right, we will go ahead and step aside for a quick commercial break. I do think it's so important. I think this is significant legislation. I think it can have an impact. I think it should be fully debated in front of the American people. Again, there's a lot of wraparound things that both sides can agree on. Let's get this one done. We'll be right back.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
This weekend is the 193rd Annual General Conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's been a little over 5 years since President Russell M. Nelson became the prophet and leader of the church. The editor of the Church News, Sarah Jane Weaver, sat down with three of President Nelson's children to talk about their dad from pretty unique perspectives. And Sarah joins us in studio. You have a special coming up on KSL News Radio over conference weekend. These interviews that you did some of his children. I want to start with just playing a little clip from one of President Nelson's daughters, one of his many daughters, Laurie Marsh, on what her dad was like when he came home.
And the thing about Daddy with his routine is when he was home, he was home. I don't remember him watching TV. I do remember him changing diapers and reading books and helping us with homework. And when he was home, it was time for the family.
So, Sarah, as you had the chance to sit down with some of the children there and get that perspective, what were some of the lessons learned for you from the children?
Well, you know, it was such an interesting interview to gain sort of a behind-the-scenes look at the life of President Russell M. Nelson. And the thing that was most interesting to me is that they reported that he directed and led his family the same way he leads the church. And they said he had high love and high expectations and really did spend each of his moments engaged in what was directly in front of him.
Yeah, I love that. One of the daughters commented, and we'll take a listen to this, on that discipline component, how he lives his life, how he raised the family, and his role as president of the church.
As a father, he's very loving. And, well, as the prophet, too, you've seen. Just very Christ-like love for everyone. Another word I think of is discipline. He's very disciplined, and that, by no coincidence, is tied to the word disciple.
So, Sarah Jane, as you went through that, and you've been able to observe President Nelson in a host of settings and circumstances all around the world, what is some of that perspective? What are some of the other things on this great conference weekend special that was originally of a Church News podcast? Tell us just a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I was so interested in this image they portrayed of President Nelson. And we actually said, well, were there things that he ever did that were hard for the family? And they said, oh, yes. You know, the Nelson family had 10 children. The first 9 were daughters. And they said Sister Nelson would get one of the little babies down to sleep, and President Nelson would come home and pick that baby up. And I thought, isn't that funny that's what he cannot resist? He could not resist, you know, picking up and cuddling one of those children that he cared for so deeply. And we have seen that reflected in his ministry around the world. Children are drawn to him, and he spends time with them and gets down on their level and looks them in the eyes, and they feel the love that he has for them.
Yeah, and that is one of the things that you learn traveling with President Nelson, is you can't keep him away from the children, and you can't keep the children away from him. And we saw that in places like Uruguay and Southeast Asia and so many other places. There is just that natural connection and bond between the two. You mentioned President Nelson's only son, who always gets favorite son status in the family with 9 sisters. But he shared in your podcast, and what we shared on KSL News Radio as part of this conference weekend special, Russell M. Nelson Jr., talking about what he learned from his dad after his mother passed away.
Then I just kind of said, what do you want us to do now? Asking from a point of, how can we help you? What can we do for you? And he just said, just go home and be with your children. And love them and teach them. And so that right there was, to me, a good window into the eternities of how we just keep going.
Sarah, so give us some, obviously, losing a spouse is no easy task for anyone. I thought that was a fascinating thing from Russell M. Nelson Jr., saying that his dad said, just go home and be with your kids. That is what I need you to do.
Well, and his daughter, Gloria Arion, who was also part of this interview, said that President Nelson spent hours playing the piano. Mm. You know, he has perfect pitch. He is gifted on the piano, and she said she felt his grief as he played the piano.
Wow.
And he would come over on Sunday afternoons and sit at their piano, and so I think all of us have to find a way to deal with grief, and it certainly was no easier for President Nelson.
Yeah, such great perspective. Again, KSL News Radio is your place to just lock it in over the weekend. You'll have all of the conference sessions we broadcast on KSL News Radio. We have special conference programming in between the sessions, after the sessions. So just leave it on. Stay with us. And some great things, including this amazing special from Sarah Jane Weaver and the Church News about President Russell M. Nelson as seen through the eyes of his children. So fascinating. And Sarah, I can't let you go before you give us a little preview in terms of what we're watching for, what we're likely to see as we enter another historic conference weekend.
I think conference is always an exciting time for members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It makes everyone feel connected globally because everyone's getting the same message in one of 98 languages that are translated. I think we're all always excited to see if there'll be temple announcements. President Nelson has announced 118 temples during his time as leader of the church. And that brings the total number of temples that are announced under construction or dedicated to 300.
Wow, that's an amazing number, and a very short order, and under some pretty difficult years as well in the midst of pandemics and so on. So that's a fascinating thing. You talk about some of the behind-the-scenes things that take place in terms of translation, number of languages. We also know that the Tabernacle Choir has a very international focus. We'll have Mike Levitt joining us on Friday to talk about that in particular. What else are you keeping your eye on as you roll into conference weekend?
Well, I am excited to see international members of the choir. We're always excited just to see and feel the energy of a gathering in downtown Salt Lake. I think everyone is looking and hoping that the Salt Lake Temple renovation will be completed. within the next several years, which will kind of open up downtown again.
So that
it becomes a destination place where you can really celebrate conference. But everyone can participate in any way that they can get it on KSL radio or in any of the other places that it's broadcast.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. As always, Sarah Jane Weaver is the editor of the Church News. Again, she has a Church News special. It started as a Church News special podcast with President Nelson's children. A very unique perspective at the kind of behind the scenes of Russell M. Nelson as a father, as a grandfather, as a member of a family. And that's going to air especially here on the KSL News Radio as part of our broadcast with the General Conference coming up this weekend. So all of that coming up. Stay tuned to that. Also, Sarah, where can they get the Church News podcast?
Well, the Church News podcast is available on any podcasting channel. You can also find links to it and other updates about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on thechurchnews.com.
All right. Fantastic. Sarah Jane Weaver is the editor of the Church News. And it will be a very big conference weekend, as it always is. And as always, KSL News Radio will be your home for all of the sessions that will be broadcast on KSL News Radio, as well as special programming, a wide range of topics, including I'll have one at noon on Sunday, talking about the beloved community. That wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll step aside for top of the hour news. When we come back, hour number two, stick around. We'll be right back on KSL News Radio.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news. Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Earlier today, the Senate passed the bill repealing the military authorization for the Iraq and Gulf Wars, the AUMF. The bill passed with bipartisan support on a vote of 66 to 30. But this bill doesn't just formally end those wars overseas. It's also a significant step forward for a Congress seeking to reclaim or claw back some of the constitutional war powers. The question is, what is happening and what comes next? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day?
Think again.
As we dig into this just a little bit, Nan Swift researches, writes, and builds relationships across party lines to promote our streets governance program with Congress. And Nan, thanks for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here. We don't often have good news.
Yeah. We're so glad we have some good news. And so give us, for our listeners, just kind of give a little bit of the lay of the land in terms of what was actually done today. And why is that good news?
Sure. Well, today is the culmination of a lot of work that people on both sides of the aisle, on different sides of, you know, perspectives on how we use force and our role around the world, but of everyone working together over a number of years to say, you know, these decisions about going to war are something that Congress should be doing, and we shouldn't have these dated authorities on the books that administrations could misuse. So this is a great thing that the Senate has finally done. Unfortunately, we've been here before with one house or the other taking some good steps. But, of course, we've got to get all the way to the president's desk.
That's right. So this is step one. We'll come back to the House in just a second. I want to get it just from a perspective for a second in terms of what this really means. You mentioned the fact that a president of either political party could misuse this authorization of military force. Give us some kind of a historic perspective in terms of what this is and why this really does need to be sitting squarely in Congress.
Yeah, well, the Constitution is very plain that Congress is the only part of our government that can officially declare war. So when Congress does that, Well, when the president lets Congress do that these days, we should say, and doesn't just take action on his own, when Congress does that, they pass something called an authorization for the use of military force. And in the case of Iraq, these authorizations have been on the books since the 90s, since the first Gulf War, and then again another one was passed in 2002. So it just passed the 20th anniversary of this AUMF and the 20th anniversary of the beginning of the war in Iraq, the second one. So repealing these is really important. It's time to say, you know, I'm not going to hold on to the option to, you know, invade without making a lot of big decisions, without discussing this, without debate, without Congress weighing in. And it's important for Congress to reclaim those powers and say, we're the only ones that can give you this power. And it's pretty awesome power. And there's a reason why we've vested it with the people who represent the people.
Yeah, and that's such a vital component to all of this. There have been so many areas, including this, where Congress has abdicated its power and authority to the executive branch. And of course, the executive branch, regardless of party, are all too happy to take that. And so we end up with a lot of executive orders, or we have something like Congress, you know, passing the sweeping We Shall Have Clean Air bill, and we hereby bequeath to the executive branch the ability to decide what that is and how to do it and what the penalties are. And then there's no accountability to the people who do, as you said, represent the people.
Well, and not only have we given a lot of authority to the president, in so many cases, Congress has just put spending on autopilot. So there's no one really, you know, checking those things. Anytime something says mandatory spending, that means Congress isn't going to pay attention anymore.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And so let's look at this moving forward. So we cleared the Senate hurdle. Today, what is the outlook looking like as it makes its way across the Capitol to the other side of the building and becomes a part of the House conversation?
Well, I think it would be smart for the House to take this up. McCarthy said last week that he was willing to let this go through committee to be discussed and debated, but the House has been there before. This issue has been standing out there for a long time. And, you know, I think those conversations have happened. So I would hope that this could proceed straight to the floor. Unlikely, but that would be nice. And the House has said that they will take it up. I think McCarthy would be smart to let that happen, because a lot of the folks that gave him a lot of trouble when he was trying to become Speaker are the ones that support this legislation. So it would be smart politically as well as the right thing to do from a constitutional perspective. But either way, whether the House takes it up right away or we take some time in committee, there's also the chance to get it on some must-pass legislation, you know, those big bills that we have to do every year, such as the National Defense Authorization Act. Both chambers over the years have expressed strong support doing this. The president has now said that he would be happy to sign this, that he doesn't need those authorizations to promulgate the still ongoing war on terror. And so it would be smart for this to scooch along or at least sneak a ride on something no one can stop.
Yeah, and that's so vital that we do get that clawed back again. So there's some accountability in terms of those conversations and those decisions. Again, if the members of Congress just give that broad brush and abdicate their authority to the executive branch, then when constituents come to them and say, "Hey, you know, what's going on with this, or why are we in this situation or that?" They can shrug their shoulders and say, "Hey, you know what? You'll have to go talk to somebody in the executive branch. They're responsible." It also creates a lot more politics in terms of especially our foreign entanglements and interactions, because then you sort of have this divided line in terms of who's really in charge. And if it's not to a president of your party in the White House, then you can kind of flip your talking points in terms of any kind of conflict or any kind of challenges going on around the world.
Right. It certainly does make things more complicated. One important point that both Senators Todd Young and Tim Kaine, who are the sponsors of this effort in the Senate, made is that Iraq is now a friend of ours. And so we shouldn't have something on the books that says, we could attack you, just FYI. That doesn't send a very friendly message, that doesn't make us good neighbors.
Yeah, so important. Nan Swift from R Street Governance Program. And Nan, always appreciate your perspective and nice to have you on a good news day. And hopefully we'll see this move through the House and, again, have Congress claw some of those powers back. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that's Nan Swift from the R Street Institute, the R Street's governance program with Congress. And, again, this is one of those, I know not a lot of you were thinking about that today in terms of the Iraq and Gulf Wars, but, again, these things were still on the books. And this is what happened when Congress abdicates power to the executive branch. The executive branch is not going to say no. They're going to take it. And it gives them a lot of breadth to do what they want. It gives them flexibility in terms of making decision. And it circumvents what the Constitution says when it comes especially to something like a declaration of war. And so I think this is a good thing. It's a good step in terms of how that moves through. Hopefully it will be taken up in committee in the House and then get to the House floor quickly and done and over to the president's desk. It's a bipartisan piece. I think we can get it done. It should get done. One, so that Congress can do its job. That's Congress's job. And two, so they can be held accountable for the job that they do.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Well, a certain senator from Alabama is holding up important military promotions, not because of qualifications, but politics. And while the military is supposed to be overseen by the People's House, politicizing the process does more harm than good for the American people. So I want to dig into this just a little bit. Obviously, Congress has a role to play when it comes to the military, military spending and personnel and so on. But how we go about that and when we go about that is something I just want you to think about today as we go through this. And it was really interesting. During the hearing before the Senate yesterday, Senator Tommy Tuberville from Alabama said the Pentagon's abortion policy is why he's holding up military promotions. Take a listen.
You know, I want to be clear on this. My hold has nothing to do with the Supreme Court's decision to the access of abortion. This is about not forcing the taxpayers of this country to fund abortion. That's been a bipartisan consensus for more than 40 years. The military has performed abortions for years. As of 12 days ago, y'all got the American taxpayer on the hook to pay for travel and time off for elective abortions. And you did not make this with anybody in this room or Congress taking a vote.
Okay, so important discussions, important points to have in terms of what is taxpayer funded and what is not. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin went on the offense yesterday, talking about Senator Tuberville and saying, look, the senator is blocking 160 senior military promotions. And Secretary Austin, of course, said that delaying those promotions could cause some harm to national security. Now, I think these are both really valid conversations to be having. I'm not sure they should be the same conversation. And this is where we often get into the politics of it all. So while being primarily responsible for this holdup in military promotion, Senator Tuberville insists he does not want our military to be politicized.
I'm not going to let our military be politicized. I want our military to be the strongest and the deadliest it has ever been. But I also want the administration to follow the law. As long as I have a voice in this body, Congress will write the laws, not Secretary of Defense, not the Joint Chiefs.
All right. So that's a very interesting thing. It's one of those, if you have to declare it, you may not be it. And if he's saying he doesn't want the military to be politicized, then maybe we ought to be having a slightly different conversation. Now, during a Senate Armed Services hearing yesterday, this is where Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin weighed in, expressed his concern about Senator Tuberville not approving those promotions during a time when our enemies are acting very aggressively.
This is one of the busiest times or one of the most complex times that we've seen lately. We see a war, the largest conflict in Europe since World War II. We see an aggressive China operating in the Indo-Pacific. We see Iranian-backed elements going after our troops. And there are a number of things happening globally that indicate that we could be in a contest on any one given day. Not approving the recommendation for promotions actually creates a ripple effect through the force that makes us far less ready than we need to be.
Secretary Austin went on to say there are critical positions that they're trying to fill with these promotions. Again, about 160 promotions that are being held currently by Senator Tuberville, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a position that they're trying to get filled before we get to September.
If you look at what we have coming up, I mean, there are five three-star promotions that are near term, and one of those is a commander of our fleet out in the Gulf, and that's a critical position. Then that starts to multiply you 70 more positions, 3- and 4-star positions over time. They include the chiefs of the Army, the Marine Corps, the Navy, and also the chairman's replacement at some point in time, although nobody wants to see that happen.
We definitely don't want to see that happen, but it will happen because he is going to retire. Secretary Austin also got into an area where I thought was really interesting because, again, these are not just some low-level promotions that they want to have. These are strategic positions, and they do impact families in terms of their planning, their ability to provide for themselves, send kids to college. Here's what Secretary Austin said in terms of the impact on military families.
The effects are cumulative, and they will affect it will affect families. It will affect kids going to schools because they won't be able to change their duty station, and so it's a powerful effect. And will impact on our readiness.
It is a powerful effect. And so that's something that we often don't think about. So let's say you've got one of these 160 promotions that are being held up by Senator Tuberville right now. And maybe that promotion for that family is to send either the wife or the husband. They get the promotion, and then that would cause them to transfer to another city, another state, another country. And so that means they've got to get kids in school. That means they got to get housing and everything locked in. They've got to deal with medical, all of those things that they have to deal with. But if the promotion hasn't been approved, then none of that can happen. And so there is a ripple effect that does impact not just the readiness of our troops, but it also impacts the stability of those families. Nothing's harder, I think, on military children than the uncertainty of it all. It's already a challenging situation where they do move, moving from school to school, especially in those junior high and high school years that are hard for everybody anyway. And then to have that sort of up in the air of, oh, hey, we think we're moving to South Carolina, but we're not sure because if your mom doesn't get the promotion, then we'll probably stay where we are, but we might get sent somewhere else. But where we really want to go is South Carolina because that's where the promotion is. But you can't do any of that. And so to me, that is the politicization of all of this. And the very thing that Senator Tuberville says he doesn't want to have happen, he's being part of. And it's one thing to say, I won't vote for these. It's another thing to hold them, to put that temporary hold on there. And so it all leads to kind of a pretty fuzzy communication in terms of what's really going on. And are we really looking out in the best interest of our military women and men and their families? Speaking on the Senate floor yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said this would have dire ramifications on the Senate's ability to function.
And it would paralyze the Senate if all of us had to take one roll call vote after another just to confirm routine apolitical qualified generals and other flag officers. I know that members of both sides of the aisle feel passionately at times about certain issues. We all do. But if every one of us went to the floor and said, we're holding up every general, every admiral, every flag officer until we get our way, our military would come crashing down.
So I do think this is a bipartisan one. Yeah, there are some things that need to be addressed. I think some of Senator Tuberville's challenges and questions should be answered and should be debated and should be resolved. At the same time, if we do get into this space where, as I don't often agree with Senator Chuck Schumer from the floor of the Senate, but he is right, it would cause the Senate to come to an even screechier screeching halt, non-moving screeching halt. Just imagine that if they had to have a roll call vote on all 160 of these promotions for, again, a whole host of positions inside the military. So I think this is an important one to get through, get to and get through as it relates to the Senate, get that resolved, because those promotions do matter to our military readiness, our national security, and especially to our military families that we also need to be looking out for as well. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom-of-the-hour news, but don't go anywhere. When we come back, our good friend Phelim Kine is going to join us with some insight about how the war in Ukraine is changing the dynamics on the world stage when it comes to China and Russia. You don't want to miss this conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back on Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
One of the downstream effects of the war in Ukraine is the deepening ties, this alliance of convenience between Russia and China. But the U.S. is also using the war in Ukraine to deepen its ties with the democracies, unite the rest of the world. And the question is, are these other countries, especially those in Europe, are they listening? Are they getting on board? Are things being strengthened or strained? And to help us break all of that down, we always turn to Phelim Kine, foreign affairs reporter for Politico and host of the China Watchers podcast. And Phelim, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Great piece in Politico, as always, on Ukraine and the changing math for countries who are kind of caught in this really weird spot between the U.S. and China. Give us the backstory.
Well, I think what we've seen is we've really seen that in the last 3 years, a real sea change in terms of how Europe and particularly the European Union views China and views, you know, the Biden administration's democracy agenda. When Biden came into office, there was a lot of skepticism and pushback from European leaders who didn't want to be part of this, who were looking to their extremely lucrative trade links with China and seeing a explicit move to isolate China and to move away from China as a risk to their economies. And what's happened is that the war in Ukraine has changed that calculus entirely, and particularly Beijing's alignment with Russia. We now have a much greater understanding in terms of how the EU see things as this real divide between democratic countries with respect for universal rights, rule of law, and autocratic countries like Russia, like China, that are trying to change the global system. So this has been Biden's mantra, this idea of his administration seeking to preserve and protect what he calls the rules-based international order. And it's playing out. Europe is now listening, but it's taken a while.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. We reported earlier in the show some of the happenings with the President's Democracy Summit. How that's playing out. And, of course, there's always some rumblings in those kinds of things as to, you know, who gets the best seat at the table, who gets to speak from the podium, and who is really fighting for democracy and freedom as opposed to kind of moving more down that authoritarian track. But as you look at that feeling from your unique perch there, you mentioned that Europe is listening for sure, kind of slow to it. But give us some specifics on that.
Well, I think the real sea change is the fact that there was great resistance really up until a few weeks ago, for example, from the Netherlands, in terms of an unwillingness for a company called ASML, which produces the highest technology equipment for production of semiconductors, the most important semiconductors for the production of high technology items, particularly military items. And they were pushing back hard, the EU and the Netherlands in particular, against any type of export restrictions on anything to be sent to China. And it took a lot of arm twisting by the Biden administration. But finally, the Netherlands, along with Japan, along with South Korea, are on board with that. And that's a real breakthrough because that aligns with the Biden administration's policy, which they rolled out in October in the United States, that to cut the supply lines of high technology items, particularly semiconductors, which go in everything from our phones, our cars, to our refrigerators, but the high-tech ones that can also have a dual civilian-military use. So that's been a really particularly pertinent example of how Europe is coming on, is aligning with the Biden administration in terms of separating and distancing itself from Beijing.
And I think it's so interesting. Obviously, Beijing is well aware of what's going on there. They've been deepening ties and kind of doing the political and the diplomatic dance with the places like Iran and Saudi Arabia. We know their investments in Africa and South America. I thought it was interesting just that there were many new countries invited to the summit this week with President Biden, really looking at this idea of those with the political will to advance democracy. Give us some perspective in terms of, one, what is it that China is doing, and then what does that look like for the rest of the world in terms of those fledgling democracies?
Yeah, so this is day two of the Biden administration's Summit for Democracy. It's the second one. They had the first in December 2021, and something like 120 countries were invited. And, you know, this is really a symbolic, you know, concentration and focus of this whole democracy versus autocracy narrative that the Biden administration's rolling out in terms of how it is facing off with Beijing and Russia. And what's interesting is that Beijing is launched its own democracy campaign, if you will. And the week prior, last week, they had their own democracy summit in Beijing. So what's interesting is that Beijing, Chinese government is saying, hey, you know what? We're a democracy too. We're just a different, we're a misunderstood democracy, but we are also a democracy. So what we have is we have this sort of this battle of narratives. And what Beijing is trying to do is they're trying to appeal to those countries with mixed records of democratic success, with, you know, faulty rule of law, and countries that have historical distrust of the United States. So we're talking about Turkey, about India, about South Africa, and trying to appeal to those countries and say, you know what, democracy is a big tent, so come on over with us, the Chinese democracy. And, you know, there's good trade links to go with that as well.
Yeah, those good trade links are a nice lubricant, I think, for a lot of those things in terms of, hey, our democracy is better than theirs. There's also an interesting thing, and you mentioned this in your piece that I thought really fascinating, talking about kind of these blocks forming with kind of Ukraine being the dividing line between, you know, which block you're a part of. Just describe that for us a little bit and what that might mean moving forward.
Yeah, so I mean, what we've seen is Russia and, you know, we see Russia and China aligning in terms of, you know, facing off against and criticizing any moves by the West, led by the United States, to support Ukraine in fending off Russia's aggression in Ukraine. And what you see is you have countries that are basically having to choose between whether they want to remain, you know, close sort of client states of China, which of course provides massive trade opportunities, has this very deep-pocketed international infrastructure investment program called the Belt and Road Initiative. So what you've seen is in United Nations General Assembly votes, you've seen, you know, multiple countries from the Global South, from Latin America, from Africa, either vote against or abstain from votes criticizing Russia and Russia's aggression in Ukraine. So it just tells you how some countries, even though they're nominally democratic, still want to play both sides of the street. Again, given the fact that China is this rising economic financial behemoth that they feel they can't ignore and definitely don't want to insult.
Yeah, and that's to me, that's one of the really fascinating things. It seems that China's kind of going after this three-dimensional chess in terms of their economic power, their military power, and now they're leaning into this diplomatic power. It really changes the conversation, and sometimes it feels like a lot of the West is still kind of playing checkers and reacting move to move to what China does. From your unique perspective, Phelan, what else are you seeing? Are there other moves going on within either the United States or some of our allies around the world?
Well, you know, what I think is that, again, I think we really, you know, Ukraine has become this turning point for how democratic countries, and particularly the developed Western countries, see their relationship with China and are increasingly concerned by the fact that China is unwilling to take a meaningful stand to stop the bloodshed in Ukraine. And I think this is something that we're going to be seeing more of. And I think that, you know, what's interesting is this ongoing summit for democracy that's happening right now in Washington, D.C. with President Biden. You know, the Biden administration is going to roll out literally billions of dollars in U.S. funding to support and develop and defend democracy globally over the next 3 years. So this isn't just, you know, this isn't just candy floss and rhetoric. You know, the Biden administration is going to pony up cash to make this happen. And I think that, and this is a meaningful sort of competition in terms of, you know, the financial resources that Beijing rolls out in terms of solidifying its advances. So the game is on. And it's gonna increase. It's gonna heat up in the next few years for sure.
Great insight as always, Phelan Kind, foreign affairs reporter for Politico and host of the China Watchers podcast. Phelan, appreciate your perspective on this one. I think it may be more than three dimensional chess, but there's a lot of math to it, and you got all the right numbers for us today. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
All right. Again, that's Phelan Kind, foreign affairs reporter for Politico, host of the China Watchers podcast. And just some great perspective there as we watch this summit on democracy being hosted by President Biden. As you look at all the dynamics that are going on, what China is doing economically, militarily, and now diplomatically, trying to say, hey, we're a democracy too. We're just misunderstood. And then having a lot of that great financial support in terms of being able to woo some of those South African as well as South American countries. A really interesting perspective there. We'll continue to follow all of it here on Inside Sources. We'll step aside for one last commercial break. When we come back, final thoughts on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Stick around.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Well, Congress and congressional hearings are often a place of very rich irony, to say the least. Lawmakers want competition and great products, but many of them don't know anything about how that actually works or what conditions are needed to help that actually happen. And it's a very interesting thing. So in a series of hearings today, someone who spends a lot of time attacking big companies is, of course, Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont. He is independent. He caucuses with the Democrats. And he often likes to lecture the billionaires and trillionaires and fat cats and use all the derogatory language that that he has really come to own and makes for some great social media moments. Now, today, he confronted former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, saying that he was a union buster during the Senate hearing today. And so let's start with Senator Sanders making that accusation of the Starbucks former CEO about violating labor laws, which, of course, the former CEO denied. But here's that exchange.
Are you aware that NLRB judges have ruled that Starbucks violated federal labor law over 100 times during the past 18 months, far more than any other corporation in America?
Sir, Starbucks Coffee Company unequivocally, and let me set the tone for this very early on, has not broken the law.
Senator Sanders also brought up a recent labor violation verdict leveled against Starbucks by a judge for their alleged efforts to discourage unions from forming at Starbucks stores. Here's that exchange.
Are you aware that on March 1st, 2023, an administrative law judge found Starbucks guilty of, quote, egregious and widespread misconduct, end quote, widespread coercive behavior, and showed, quote, a general disregard for the employees' fundamental rights, end quote, in a union organizing campaign that started in Buffalo, New York in 2021. Are you aware of that?
I'm aware that those are allegations, and Congress has created a process that we are following, and we're confident that those allegations will be proven false.
So that's that exchange. Also, just really interesting. So obviously, Senator Sanders had an agenda he wanted to work through there, some social media moments he was definitely trying to capture, some things I'm sure you will see in a fundraising email probably in the next hour in your email box if you're signed up for that. The interesting thing is to go past that. Again, this is the rich irony component to all of that. So the senator, of course, likes to call places like Starbucks anti-union. And really interesting, the employees at Starbucks, and I don't work at Starbucks, but the interesting thing is they actually make more money than union workers in places like New York and Chicago and Seattle. They do better. Starbucks was actually one of the first companies to offer health care benefits to those who were part-time employees to pay for college tuition. And so you can make them out to be the big, evil, awful empire, but they've actually been doing a better job than the unions on a number of these issues that Senator Sanders is saying is important. Now, I thought it was interesting that Utah Senator Mitt Romney began his comments today by noting the rich irony of the group of lawmakers sitting on the stand making these accusations and firing this criticism at the former CEO of Starbucks. Take a listen.
I also think it's somewhat rich that that you're being grilled by people who have never had the opportunity to create a single job. And yet they believe that they know better how to do so and what's best for the American worker and what's best for the American economy, what's best for growth.
So Senator Romney saying, yeah, it is a little bit rich that here Mr. Schultz was being lectured by a host of senators, and I thought Senator Romney was quite kind in his description, who had never had the opportunity to create a job other than the one they're occupying. And that is pretty rich. That is pretty ironic that this series of senators on both sides of the aisle, by the way, who have never run a lemonade stand are lecturing someone who is part of an organization that employs over 400,000 people in this country, not to mention what they do globally. Now, Senator Romney went on to affirm that any company that has broken labor laws regarding union formation should be held accountable. Of course they should.
At the same time, I agree with Senator Cassidy and with your own comments, Mr. Schultz, which is that people have a legal right to form a union. There are some employers that are not good employers, and a union is necessary to protect the rights of those individuals, and that if any enterprise, including yours, has broken the law, that it should be held accountable for having done so.
So to me, that's just one of those very rich ironies that often happens in our nation's capital. And while we're on the irony thing, I want to weigh in on one last thing today. And it was some interesting polling coming out from the Associated Press and the NORC Center for Public Affairs talking about the American people and what they think should happen with government. And here's a little irony for you. The majority of Americans in this new poll say they want the federal government to cut spending. Over 63%. They want the government to cut funding. That's a pretty significant majority in a very divided world. But here's the irony. That while everybody agrees, hey, I think we should cut spending, 63% also said that we're spending too little on health care. 62% said we need to spend more on Social Security. Same amount, 63% said we need to spend more on infrastructure. So just capture the irony of that. The majority of Americans are saying we need to cut government spending. But don't cut any spending on health care. Don't cut any spending. In fact, we need to spend more on health care. We need to spend more on Social Security. And we need to spend more on infrastructure. That's an interesting and ironic set of things going at opposite ends of the scale. It's sort of the, you know, just tax everybody but me. So I want to cut spending on everything except for the things that I want. That's also a little bit of irony. And there's a lot of it in our nation's capital. And sometimes it starts with us as citizens. So be careful of that. All right, that wraps up the show for today on Inside Sources. Thanks for joining us. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something today that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.